You're listening to This Week in Nuclear, episode number 5, January 22nd, 2006. Hey there, I'm John Wheeler, and you're listening to This Week in Nuclear, the only podcast in the world dedicated to news, facts, and commentary on the commercial nuclear power industry. We've got a ton of news to talk about, so hold on to your seat. Last week, we were going to talk about the energy bill and the incentives contained in it that are helping to promote new nuclear construction in the United States, but we ran out of time, so this week we're going to start with that. The Energy Policy Act of 2005 contains a number of provisions that support currently operating nuclear plants and contains three primary elements to stimulate construction of new plants in the United States. Before we talk about the incentives, let's talk about some of those other things that are important to the industry. The bill establishes an assistant secretary position to head the Department of Energy's Office of Nuclear Energy. This will assist the industry by raising awareness and will make sure there's somebody at the table with the industry's interests in mind when decisions are made. The energy bill also updates the tax treatment of nuclear decommissioning funds to reflect the fact that many plants are now operating in a deregulated marketplace, which was not envisioned at the time that the original bill was written. When the original bill was written, all the nuclear plants in the United States operated in a regulated market. And finally, for nuclear research and development, the bill authorizes $2.95 billion. The first $1.6 billion goes to nuclear research, which includes some money for colleges and universities, and also supports the Generation 4 Reactor Initiative and advanced fuel cycle development. The remaining $1.25 billion is set aside for the construction of a Generation 4 reactor at the Idaho National Laboratory. The reactor, called a nuclear cogen reactor, is designed to produce both electricity and hydrogen. And finally, the energy bill extends the Price-Anderson Act for another 20 years. The Price-Anderson Act provides the legal framework that would, in essence, provide private citizens with insurance reimbursement for losses incurred in the event of a nuclear reactor accident. And now for the financial incentives. The energy bill provides three basic financial incentives to get companies in the United States to build new nuclear plants. The first is a production tax credit. The first 6,000 megawatts of capacity that gets built receives a 1.8 cents per kilowatt hour production tax credit. That's pretty significant considering that most nuclear plants in the country are producing power at less than 1.8 cents per kilowatt hour today. The production tax credit lasts for the first 8 years of plant operations. The next incentive is called standby support. In essence, it's investment protection that's designed to protect the investors against delays in the construction process. The first two plants built get 100% standby support up to $500 million each, and the next four units built get 50% standby support up to $250 million each. The standby support is designed to cover delays caused by things like Nuclear Regulatory Commission's failure to comply with schedules for inspections, tests, etc., as well as delays caused by litigation. And finally, there are construction loan guarantees. The energy bill authorizes the U.S. Energy Secretary to provide loan guarantees to support development of nuclear power plants and other innovative energy technologies. Those construction loan guarantees can cover up to 80% of the project cost. For all three of these incentives, there are conditions and limits, but overall it's a package that's designed to stimulate constructions of new plants, and right now it certainly appears to be working. Let's take a look at some likely scenarios. If you're listening on your computer, then you can go to my website and follow along the timeline that I posted there. If you're in a car or an airplane or away from your computer, stop by later on and take a look. The web address is jkwheeler.podomatic.com, or you can also go to my blog at thisweekinnuclear.blogspot.com, where the same graphics are posted. I've developed a hypothetical timeline that shows what a utility would need to go through in order to build and bring to completion a new nuclear unit in the United States. The first step is to complete the detailed engineering and, if possible, get an early site permit. A number of utilities have indicated that they're going through that process. In fact, 10 different companies in the United States have announced that they are considering building up to about 15 new reactors. Three companies, Exelon, Entergy, and Dominion, have filed for early site permits. All 10 companies plan to file for construction and operating licenses in late 2007 or early 2008. Once a utility has filed for a combined operating license, or COL, the NRC has to review and approve the license. That's going to take anywhere from 24 to 36 months. During that period of time, about 12 to 16 months before the COL is issued, the utility needs to begin ordering long lead time components. That brings our timeline into early 2010 to early 2011 for the combined operating license to be issued. Then the construction phase starts. Different reactor vendors are proclaiming different construction periods, but the best estimates are anywhere from 40 to 50 months for construction. That would bring the end of construction to late 2013 to mid 2015, when a plant would be ready to begin operations. That's consistent with some of the time estimates that the large utilities have discussed publicly. And I might add that the last 10 nuclear plants built in the world were finished on schedule and on budget. And so the race is on. A number of utilities are lining up at the queue. Early site permits are going. Detailed engineering is underway. And it looks like the major nuclear players in the United States are trying to beat one another to the punch to be the first in line so they gain the most out of the incentives contained in the energy bill. We'll be following this story and keeping track of all those major players as time goes on and keep you up to abreast of the key events in the process. On a personal note, I am really excited about what's going on in the industry. You know, for years and years, the industry has really been struggling, and I've worked at stations that for 1 week to the next, we weren't sure we were going to be allowed to continue to operate. I'm really excited about what I see going on in the industry, and I hope to share that excitement with you as the future unfolds. Now for some world news in the nuclear industry. Things continued down a predictable path this week in the situation with Iran. On Wednesday, Iran tried to get Britain, Germany, and France back to the negotiating table, and all three refused. In fact, on late Wednesday, the International Atomic Energy Agency announced they would be holding an emergency meeting to discuss the proposal to refer Iran to the United Nations Security Council. The emergency meeting is scheduled for February 2nd. On Friday, Iran threatened to begin moving funds out of European Union banks, and on Saturday it began to do so. Analysts estimate the funds to be about $50 billion. Iran also asked OPEC to reduce oil production, an attempt to use its position in OPEC as leveraged with the West. One of the things that's interesting about the situation in Iran is that it comes on the heels of a very similar situation in which Russia intentionally curtailed its natural gas supplies to Eastern Europe in order to effect a political change. What we're seeing, in my opinion, is the beginnings of the new world economy. In the future, the international currency will be energy, and energy will drive the economies of the world. As the developing nations of the world begin to use more and more energy, energy will become more and more scarce. I think a lot of world leaders see that, and they see nuclear power as an opportunity for them to become less reliant on foreign energy sources. That scenario is playing itself out all around the world today. In other world news, the Coburg station in South Africa on Christmas Day sustained damage to its main turbine generator. The damage was apparently caused by foreign material inside their main turbine generator and will require at least 3 months to repair. This comes at an inopportune time for the South African government, who is trying to bolster public support for the Pebble Bed Reactor project. Their government remains committed to developing a Pebble Bed modular reactor with the help of several other nations. The Pebble Bed modular reactor is essentially a gas-cooled reactor, but rather than the fuel elements that are used today, The pebble bed reactor uses small spheres or pebbles of uranium dioxide fuel coated in graphite. The nuclear reaction that takes place in the reactor is cooled by helium gas that enters the top of the vessel at about 500 degrees centigrade and flows downward through the spheres of fuel, leaves the bottom of the vessel having been heated to about 900 degrees centigrade. This heated gas then passes through a gas turbine that is used to generate electricity. And here's some interesting news from China. China is going to be opening a theme museum on nuclear power. It's under construction now and expected to open in April. The cost of the museum is about $31 million, and it features nuclear engineering and technology, computer science, and wind tunnel technology. The nuclear technology section is the main part of the museum, and it's divided into a number of areas, one of which is the application of nuclear power and peaceful utilization of nuclear technology. You know, I think China is onto something here. They are going to be building a huge number of nuclear power plants over the next 20 years, and they need public support and public awareness of it. Nuclear is going to be a core part of China's energy solution, and they're taking that to heart, hopefully learning some lessons from the rest of the world and taking some steps to educate the population on the benefits of nuclear technology. In Japan, the Onagawa Unit 2 nuclear plant in the Migai Prefecture was given a clean bill of health following a major earthquake last August. The quake measured a 7.2 on the Richter scale, which is strong enough to cause serious damage to normal structures. A detailed inspection determined that the plant was not affected. In fact, an engineering analysis shows that the reactor safety systems would remain functional even after a catastrophic earthquake measuring 8.2. Because the Richter scale is a logarithmic scale, an 8.2 would be about twice as strong as the 7.2 earthquake they actually experienced. And by the way, the recent devastation in Pakistan was caused by an earthquake measuring 7.2. So this was truly a major earthquake. As a precaution, the utility shut down all three units at the site following the earthquake to allow detailed inspection and analysis. Unit 2 will restart by the end of January, and the other two units will follow after their inspections. This is a great one to remember because the anti-nuclear movement is constantly using the threat of earthquake damage to spread fear in the communities around nuclear plants. Here we have an actual case of a nuclear plant having experienced a massive earthquake with no impact to reactor safety. Speaking of Japan, this last Monday marked the kickoff of the first inspection of a nuclear plant by their new independent nuclear oversight organization, the Japan Nuclear Technology Institute. The new organization is modeled after the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations in the USA. The review is being performed at the Fukushima station by a 15-member team that includes two members of IMPO. The inspection will cover six areas: corporate governance, operations, maintenance, engineering support, radiation protection, and the plant's use of industry operating experience. The new Japanese organization was formed in April 2005 with the goal of helping the industry improve their performance. I think this is a great initiative. The Institute of Nuclear Power Operations in the USA, more than any other organization, has helped create a culture of openness and information sharing that's unique to the nuclear industry, and has contributed heavily to the safety and performance improvements over the last two decades. I've personally participated in a number of these plant evaluations in the USA, Canada, and the United Kingdom, and I can tell you that they really do work. I commend the Japanese nuclear industry for this initiative. It'll be difficult and there'll be a lot of work, but the paybacks will be tremendous in the long run. And here's yet another case of Russia using its energy monopoly as the primary gas supplier in Europe as leverage in its dealings with its neighbors. Bulgaria imports more than 97% of its natural gas from Russia, and this week we learned that Russia is threatening to more than double the price that it charges. At stake is the contract to build two new nuclear units at the Belin station in Bulgaria. Russia is competing for the project and has indicated they plan to raise natural gas prices, but they might reconsider if they're awarded the contract to build the nuclear plants. It's this kind of behavior that has the rest of Europe looking very hard at their energy mix and considering how dependent they want to be on Russia. Bulgaria may be reluctant to award the nuclear plant project to Russia because that would further reinforce the monopoly. Contracts to build the plant will be awarded in the spring. In a related story, Greenpeace attempted to block the new nuclear plant project in Bulgaria, but they lost a court battle this week. Hey, score another one for the good guys. The Belene project has widespread public and political support in Bulgaria, in part because two Soviet-designed nuclear plants will be removed from service later this year. That was part of Bulgaria's agreement with the European Union. Bulgaria has four operating nuclear plants that supply 42% of their electricity, but that'll drop in half later this year when those two plants are taken out of service. Since most of the remaining power is generated by natural gas-fired units, Bulgaria will have to increase its natural gas imports to make up for the lost nuclear capacity, at least until they can get the new units online. Here's an update on a story we covered a couple of weeks ago. Recalling that anti-nuclear consumer advocates in Iowa were attempting to block the sale of the Duane Arnold nuclear plant to FPL Energy, this week the Iowa Utilities Board rejected those requests and reaffirmed its approval for the sale to proceed. The board ruled that the appeals from the state consumer advocate and the Iowa Consumers Coalition did not raise any new arguments. The next day, Minnesota utility regulators approved the sale, clearing the final hurdle. So now the sale's been approved by the state regulators from three states, Iowa, Minnesota, and Illinois, and by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has approved the operating license transfer to FPL Energy. Alliant Energy now has all the regulatory approval it needs to close the deal. Iowa's consumer advocate John Perkins says he disagrees with the board's findings and he is considering an appeal in court. He has 30 days to make the appeal. The biggest news in the U.S. this week was the Department of Justice indictment of three individuals who were involved in the 2002 event at the Davis-Besse station in which the utility discovered boric acid had severely corroded a section of the reactor head. Two were employees of the utility, First Energy, and a third was a contract employee. All three are charged with intentionally misleading the Nuclear Regulatory Commission about the thoroughness of inspections that had been performed on the reactor vessel. The indictment states they hid information to delay more inspections until the next refueling outage. The inspections were in fact delayed, and when they were performed during the next outage, they revealed 6 inches of corrosion in the reactor vessel head. Officials have said that it's the most extensive corrosion ever seen at a U.S. nuclear reactor. First Energy has already acknowledged that its employees failed to provide the NRC with complete and accurate information, and they paid the largest fine ever imposed by the NRC, $5.5 million. In this recent indictment, First Energy issued a statement saying that prosecutors had agreed not to pursue criminal charges against the company in exchange for $23 million in fines, $5 million in other spending, including reimbursement to the government, Habitat for Humanity work, and university research into energy efficiency. I'm not going to jump to conclusions about the guilt or innocence of these three individuals. That's a question that'll play itself out in the court systems. But I can tell you, this indictment sends a clear message to the rest of the industry that this is serious business. If you decide on a career in the nuclear industry, then you accept the public trust and the responsibility to put the reactor and personnel safety first and foremost in your decisions and in your actions. That's a commitment to the public, to your coworkers, and to the nuclear industry around the world. This is an unforgiving business in the sense that we all suffer the consequences of any mistake made at any plant around the world. It can be an exciting and rewarding career, but it demands absolute integrity. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining the show and hope to have you back next week. This is John Wheeler for This Week in Nuclear. Have a great week.